The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, especially since we're doing a special time for the Tuesday evening program tonight, an hour earlier, 6 p.m. for those of you in California, 9 p.m. for those of you in the Eastern time zone. And again, we thank you for joining us. A couple of quick announcements. We're on the 60-minute format tonight. So once again, watch your time. If you want to get an email in or a phone call for our guests, do so while we're still on the air. We will go over and longer if the need is there and you're asking questions and we're in the middle of a great discussion. But plan on this being the 60-minute formatted Space Show program. Friday, A Parabolic Arc is back with us. You all know who that is, Doug Messier. So we'll be finding out what's new and what's happening in the commercial space and the all space fronts through the parabolic arc eyes. So tune in on Friday morning, 9:30 California time for that one. And then Sunday is your day to talk about whatever is important and on your minds with our Open Lines program. And we hope you do call. The Open Line Show works a whole lot better with toll-free calls rather than just emails. And, of course, you can talk to other callers, our new feature for Open Lines. And then next year will be a next week will be a regular Space Show week. So for today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. As usual, no call screeners, no blockages, nothing like that. Just call and be patient, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments on our blog. And to do that, you would go to our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu, and you'll see our program tonight. And our guest is Janelle Wellens. And click on that show. That is our blog page as well as our archive page. Go ahead and open it all the way to the bottom. You can see a place for comments and questions. As soon as you hit send, I'll get a copy of whatever it is you wrote, and I can bring it up and ask our guest on air. So those are the three ways to reach us tonight. But, of course, this being a talk show, we really do prefer to talk with you. So that toll-free number, once again, is 1-866-687-7223. Don't forget to check out our website newsletter. It's current and it's completely posted. First quarter is filling up rapidly. Scroll down past this week on that newsletter and you'll see all of what we have planned for first quarter 2020. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or rapidly download a show to whatever device or computer you would like. We do have a store. I know the gift-giving season is behind us, but many of you have birthdays coming up or something special, and maybe you want to do something for your favorite Space Show listener. So check out our Space Show store. We have all sorts of logo wear available, from phone covers to T-shirts to hats to dog clothes. So to get there, look for Pepper the dog. Listening to the Space Show, and she will guide you to our Cafe Press store. So thank you for checking that out, everybody. And then do remember to look in that upper left menu. So Listen Live is an important button in that upper left menu. It tells you how to listen to all of our live broadcasts like we're doing now, podcast, and then also archives, which are compressed MP3s on our website. If you have any questions about podcast or any of this, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember our podcasts are available in quite a few venues for iPhones and Apple products, as well as for the Android market. If you have any questions, let me hear from you about that, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, let me remind everybody that The Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We're listener-supported and funded, meaning you, the listener, keep the program alive. So if you like it, please do support us. I know we're just coming off our annual campaign, but for those of you that did not participate in that campaign for whatever reason, you may want to make a contribution and help support us moving into 2020, which is our 19th broadcasting year. So there's a big PayPal button at the top of all of our website pages that will take you to PayPal for an electronic contribution. And then if you're interested in using a check, there are instructions there, or email me and I'll tell you how to write the check and also how to mail it out to us for those of you who don't want to do PayPal. But it is your support that makes The Space Show happen. We wouldn't be doing this program without your support. We thank you very, very much for it. And remember, you do get some tax advantages, both federally and with California, by supporting us, as we are a nonprofit 501c3. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Also, in terms of support, we have sponsors. So the sponsors get that banner ad you see going across our homepage, and they can change the banner as often as they like. It's up to them to change it. And on the longer shows, as you know, we read out or provide a message from the sponsor, 60 seconds or less usually, based on what the sponsor wants to say. On the shorter shows, like tonight, we shout out to our sponsors, and we thank them very much. We don't do the longer messages to save guest talk time. But we do want to thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. Without their great support, we would not be doing the space show. At least it would not look like anything it is today. So we're really, really appreciative of all of our sponsors. Listeners, that brings us to our program today. So I've been reading in different things on the web, and some people have been sending them to me, about JPL's Janelle Wellens and space settlement on Titan. So I used to think this was a foolish topic, but many of you over the years have pounded my head in on that one. And I've had many guests on the show who have advocated and talked about the advantages of space settlement in Titan, so I like to cover the topic. I probably won't live to see it happen. Maybe some of you will. I don't know. But it's plausible, and we will look forward to talking to Janelle tonight about just how plausible that is and why. Our guest is at JPL. She's an MIT graduate in aerospace engineering, and she works as an instrument operations engineer on different missions. We'll also talk to her about that job description. It's very interesting. And on all the 19 years of the space show, we have not talked to, per se, an instrument operations engineer. So I want to know more about this particular position. She creates the commands for and monitors the health and safety for a variety of instruments. She also works in development, specifically for ground data systems and instrument operations, concepts for the MAIA, I hope I'm doing that right, M-A-I-A mission. And she serves on the advisory board of Magnitude.io, which is a company that creates project-based learning experiences for STEM education. She's also on the board of the Pasadena YWCA, heading the programs and committee and developing STEAM activities for middle school age girls. And when she isn't doing all of that, you can find her scuba diving, doing video games, reading, etc., and a well-balanced aerospace engineer. Janelle, welcome to The Space Show. It's a pleasure to meet you and talk to you. How are you tonight?
Oh, thank you so much for such a kind introduction, David.
Well, it's all true. You gave it to me. So, why don't we start out? What actually is an instrument operations engineer? That's the first time I've ever heard this term in the 19 years of doing the show.
That's actually, I'm so glad you asked me that question, because when I actually got my offer letter to come work at JPL, I had the same question. What in the world does an instrument operations engineer do? It turns out that my job description is basically that we are responsible for generating the actual binary data that ends up getting sent to the scientific instruments that we put on our spacecraft in flight. And so this involves a lot of different things, and depending on which mission you are, your operation schedule and what you do to actually generate those commands can look very different. But in general, you can imagine a process where you're using software that has been developed by some software engineers, and if you had the chance to work in the development of the mission, like I am now on the Maya mission, you did pronounce that correctly.
Okay.
You have a chance to create all the requirements for how you, like the tools that you will be using to look like. And so I am able to plan ahead what I want the commands to be for our instrument by working with the needs of the science team and what our overall mission objectives are. And those get passed off to the spacecraft team to eventually be transmitted to the spacecraft wherever it may be. We also then are responsible for making sure that whatever was planned and sent up there actually happened. And if it doesn't happen, we're responsible. We're on the end, basically, to fix any problems, because the operations team is what's left after the spacecraft has been sent up.
So you're writing the code to send to the spacecraft, but you're not the ones that send it to the spacecraft?
We are the ones to send it to the spacecraft. It can get a little confusing here. Most of what I do is in the Unix system, and so it's often working on remote servers and sending over the commands that I generate, that binary data, to whoever is hosting our instrument. And that could be within JPL. It could be like on the Cassini mission when I was operating the cameras, VIMS and ISS. We were able to speak with the spacecraft team because they were on the same floor as us. And so it was a lot different than, per se, on the Maya mission. We are being hosted by a commercial spacecraft, and so we would be sending those commands to them remotely and verifying with them that they received them, and they would ultimately be responsible for getting them to the antenna that's going to radiate those commands to our spacecraft.
So you're essentially on the team that's going to tell the spacecraft and the instruments what to do.
Exactly.
So how do you know how to tell it what to do? I guess I'm asking questions from someone who doesn't know what in the hell they're talking about.
Okay.
But so you're writing a program, I guess, right, or codes to tell it to call home, to tell it to look at this rock 30 inches over to the left, or
right. Yeah, you are not far off. What we're really doing is a lot of it is scripting, so I would call it a step down from writing the code. In fact, the code that helps us plan what we're going to do is written in advance during development stages. So this is a good example to show you how the process kind of works. I'm working with a team of software engineers right now on the Maya mission, which is going to be Earth observing.
Okay.
Now, the main mission or main goal for this mission is to look at different targeted cities around the world so that we can measure aerosols in the air. And this will help us understand a lot more about pollution and what kinds of pollutants are causing health issues for people. So the software engineers are taking the requirements that me and my lead came up with and turning that into actual software that I will be using in the future to generate the commands I need. So the software kind of looks like, for the planning at least, it will calculate based on the orbit and where the spacecraft is and the instrument is, what targets can be seen from the instrument. And it will record all those for however long for whatever time period I ask for it to do so. And after it does that, I take a look. I make sure everything is okay. It doesn't conflict with anything that the principal investigator requested. And then I turn those into the actual commands that get sent to the instrument and make sure that everyone who's receiving data downstream also gets a copy of what we plan to do, so that if anything's wrong, someone's going to catch it in that downflow.
Do you see the material when it comes back, or does that go someplace else?
I do. So what I'm most interested in is the housekeeping telemetry, which is the telemetry that tells us about the instrument's health and safety. And so this can look like anything from temperatures, currents, voltages. I want to make sure and monitor that nothing is out of the limits that we set for it. And these limits can change over time. There's, for example, we also like to trend data. So even though it may not be frighteningly out of the limits that we set for it beforehand, it may not look the way it should be or is showing degradation. So these are all the types of things that I'm keeping my eye on to make sure the instrument's functioning. But we also get feedback from those on the science team, too. They're looking at the actual images that we're producing from the science data and letting us know if that matches up with what we plan to do. So I always use as an example, if we plan to look at Los Angeles at a certain time, and the science team is like, wait a second, this actually looks like the ocean. You clearly missed. Then I'm going to go back to my other telemetry to see if the instrument was malfunctioning.
Okay, so is this a big team at JPL, or are you the only person doing it, or is it just a handful of people?
Well, that's a great question. So the people who do instrument operations, are a lot of them are in a group called Instrument Operations Engineers, which makes sense, but there are still others at JPL who do instrument ops without having that title per se. And I wouldn't say it's a handful, because any mission that we have where we are responsible for the operations, they're going to need someone from our group or someone who is capable to actually do those operations. So I'm not the only one by far doing this kind of job.
Did you actually learn how to do this when you were a student at MIT, or is this on-the-job training?
A lot of this job has been on-the-job training, mainly because at MIT, I didn't exactly get a chance to operate anything in space, though I would have loved to. A lot of what I do here, though, has been learning through fire and basically coming to understand the intricacies of what it takes to operate something that's not at your planet, not here, and working with my coworkers to better understand the complex system.
So what's interesting, we talk about all these planetary missions. We have the PIs on and other people on for the rovers. Cassini has been featured on the space show dozens of times. And, you know, we hear them talk about we're sending commands up. We're doing this. Sometimes there's a problem, and they're sending commands to try to fix a problem. Some, you know, Mars rovers get stuck or something happens. But we don't really have a real grasp on the operations and what it takes to communicate and direct and get performance out of the rovers or the satellites. I mean, this is sort of the first glimpse we've gotten to it. So it sounds awfully involved and complicated to me, and this is a whole new arm of engineering and people supporting these missions that we haven't really talked about much on the space show, and that, at least for myself, I've not really even thought about. But there's an awful lot that goes into it, and people seem to gloss over this, and maybe they don't realize it, or maybe they just sort of dismiss it as part of the boilerplate, you know. But this stuff has, I guess this is why there's so many people on a team. To go to Mars or to go to Saturn.
Absolutely, absolutely. And honestly, when all is going well, my job should be smooth sailing. That's how I would love for it to be, because that means everything is working properly, nothing special had to be done. But when it gets really interesting is when something is anomalous, something goes wrong. That's when we have to really put our brains together understand the instrument's behavior and come up with a viable solution, oftentimes when the people who have built the instrument have moved on to other projects and may not be, we may not be able to consult them. So the more I know about how this instrument is built, how it works, what the science goals are, the better I'll be at my job in the case that something goes wrong.
You have a question from James, who is in Phoenix, and he says, does the technology for this field evolve and develop from mission to mission, or is what this position would do for, say, a mission that launched in 2005 or 2006 be pretty much the same as, say, the Mars 2020 rover?
That's a great question, and the answer is yes. The technology does evolve, which is great for me. Since I worked on Cassini when I first got to JPL about 3.5 years ago, it gave me a lot of material to contrast with this more modern project that I'm working on now, Maya. I can tell you that on Cassini, trending some types of data and keeping track of how the instrument was performing, some of those tasks were done in, like, Excel, believe it or not. But with more modern technology, with all these coding languages, we're able to automate a lot more on these newer missions, which, again, makes my job easier, which is how I like it to be and how I plan for it to be. Another cool development and something that I found really amazing is that there was some work being done in my section to make a telemetry monitoring tool. So normally when I'm monitoring telemetry, we have a screen that we can pull up, and it lists all of the telemetry channels that we care about and maybe all the rest of them on another page that you don't scrutinize as carefully each day. But the great thing about this new software that was developed is that it incorporated some machine learning. So not only would values be highlighted yellow or red, or you get a text message or email if some kind of telemetry channel was out of its limits, but this machine learning software would tell you if the telemetry was not what was to be expected for a similar event that you've done in the past. And as an instrument operator, this is huge for me because this, again, ties into not just how the instrument is performing right now, but the instrument's behavior over time so that we can better understand how it's doing. So the answer is yes, and I'm really happy that we're able to use this new technology as missions go on.
Pretty amazing. So am I to understand that part of this multi-billion dollar Cassini mission operated on Windows software?
We actually had Solaris machines. I heard about some Fortran. I didn't touch or look at that. A lot of Perl was used. But basically, whatever operating system was used for the development is the same operating system that we used today, or back when Cassini was still flying. It was interesting because I couldn't just come in and use these cool new coding languages I learned from MIT to make my job easier. Instead, I had to kind of adapt and use whatever was used to make that mission work for me.
Interesting. Well, maybe I should call you to get my office programs to work better. So. Why Titan? What is there that grabs your attention about possible settlement someday, or maybe some eon might be a better term, for Titan? It's cold there. It's a long ways off. What gets you about Titan for possible human settlement?
You know, Titan started to come to my mind as a place that we could settle one day. And mind you, I'm not a scientist, so this is personal opinion. But, you know, we often talk about the moon and Mars as places for us to settle. And it's totally understandable why we do that. But working on the Cassini mission and learning more about Saturn and its satellites, it just opened up my whole understanding of what was possible. And so Titan in particular is a pretty cool place, in my opinion. One, because it's mysterious. We have that thick atmosphere covering the moon, and that's one of the reasons why Cassini carried along the Huygens probe, so that we could see what was underneath that thick atmosphere that we had never seen before. And what was found was quite amazing. The chances of there being lakes, rivers, just like here on Earth, on another body within our own solar system, just unreal. And even though those lakes and rivers are not exactly made out of water, it still was very fascinating to me that that was the case. And there are a lot of fun things that you can do as well with the atmosphere. It's so thick that if you were to, like, strap some makeshift wings on, you could actually fly in that environment. Now, who wouldn't love that for a future settlement place?
Well, you'd have to wear a lot of heavy clothing, I guess, and whatever else. But so it would support, like you see those pictures from the 1500s with people putting big wings on and moving their arms. It would support that to fly.
Oh, absolutely, and that just is so amazing to me. It makes me giddy and excited, and as much as it may not be the most feasible choice or the most cost-effective choice or realistic choice, I like to think of it when we talk about future settlement places just because I'm inspired by it.
Where would one live on Titan? Would it be on the surface? Would it be in the thick atmosphere? What would you do? Where would you set up a settlement?
So I don't know much about the geography of Titan, but we would definitely be on the surface. So the materials, the methane, chips, because it's so cold that it's basically icy there, we wouldn't want to have skin to skin. We wouldn't want to touch it, basically. So we would need to have a spacesuit that was able to withstand the temperature issues, the chemicals that we'd be exposed to. But we would be able to be on the ground. And there would be some interesting engineering problems to get into because we'd be very, very far from the sun. And on top of that, we have that atmosphere hindering the sunlight even more. So there'd be a lot of other things to think about. But we could be on the surface, actually.
What is the gravity on Titan?
It's about the gravity on our own moon. Actually,
so it's 1/6 of Earth, roughly.
Roughly, yeah.
Have you ever seen a somewhat serious proposal about a settlement on Titan? Or I know you've seen other literature probably about it, but does anything appear that like tries to plan something out, for example?
I have never seen any serious proposals come through, and I do have some friends who are still studying Titan and thinking about future robotic missions to the moon, but I would think it has to do with, well, a lot of things. One, just being able to get to Titan, that trip, it wouldn't be short, like getting to the moon or getting to Mars. And some even say getting to Mars is a challenge because of how long it could take and just the dynamics of having people in a small confined space living together for 6 to 9 months. That could cause so many psychological issues that to think about getting to Titan, which would be years, 4 to 7 years, depending on whatever trajectory you decided to take, I can understand why people aren't eager to put that in the forefront. I do think that once we start to seriously think about the technology that is needed to keep people alive in on a surface, in some on whatever body that may be, the moon, Mars, that's when we'll start to really be able to think of these things at Titan, for instance.
Of course, if we had advanced propulsion or nuclear propulsion, we could get there a lot faster.
That would be great. It would also be great as a power source once we get there. Don't really have to worry about bringing some giant solar panels, which I don't really know how efficient that would be.
probably not that much out there.
Right.
Have you seen missions planning to return to Titan to check for habitability or anything like that? Is there any interest that you hear people talking about that they'd like to propose a mission or do something like that?
Yes, and I really wish I looked this up, but it's a part of the Decadal survey. There was proposed a robotic mission to go back to Titan. And, man, I should have done my homework. I could have expected this kind of question. But there are serious plans to return there one day. Absolutely.
Of all the places in the solar system, I guess there's not that many. Have you thought about ranking them as Titan your number one? Like, do you think more highly of it than for settlement, for example, than Mars?
Okay, are we talking settlement specifically or just general favorites?
General favorite. I don't know that you could think specifically about settlement on Titan like you could Mars.
Right.
I think there's a lot more potential for Mars, and that's challenging enough.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm going to throw you a curveball.
Okay.
And I'm
going to
say that my favorite is Enceladus.
Okay. And so why Enceladus?
I just think, Enceladus amazed me. When I started working on the Cassini mission, I didn't know much about that mission before I started at JPL. And it launched when I was really young, 3 years old. So to even have the opportunity to be a part of the mission was huge to me. I felt like I was a part of this historic event, this historic milestone that humans made. And so getting on the project and learning about the existence of this icy world that likely had a running ocean underneath its surface that was sending plumes of organic materials out into Saturn's rings, I was just in shock. And then you look at the images of this moon, and it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous, with tiger stripes going down its side and that just that brilliant whitish-blue color. It's just my first taste of reality that we really might have life right here within our own solar system. It's something I had seen in headlines before, but always in reference to Mars. I had never known that we had this beautiful moon that had water, just like our own ocean, happening right here, right now. And I know that Europa is also a moon that fits this description pretty well, but I have to give it to Enceladus because Saturn is my first love.
Do you think there's a possibility of some kind of life on Enceladus now?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes. Well, if I were to bet on it, I would bet that there was.
You're talking, I take it, microbial life, right? Bacteria,
yes.
Something, not
yes.
Life like us.
Right, exactly. That would be super exciting. And sometimes we would joke about that on the Cassini mission. Someone had a really old article from some, like, satire magazine that showed, like, pictures of cats roaming one of Saturn's moons.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. But, yes, we're talking at a much simpler level of life when we talk about life on Enceladus. But even that excites me.
An email is from Kathy in Seattle, and she says, being an engineer in JPL must be an awfully strong grounding place to work because people have to be pretty serious and not so struck out into fantasy. Otherwise, the engineering probably wouldn't work. What do you hear in terms of chat or maybe scuttlebutt around JPL about extraterrestrial life on some of these places or even elsewhere? Do people talk about it? Do they think it's out there? Do they think there is intelligent life out there?
Wow, that's a loaded question. So I guess I can start off here. Basically, every year for JPL's birthday, which is on Halloween, October 31st, we have a pumpkin carving contest. And I went in person for the first time this year, and I was laughing almost the whole time because people made these amazing pumpkin creations, I should say, of, you know, like an alien coming out of Area 51, shooting lasers out of his eyes towards these people running away. Or they have, like, videos saying, we're keeping it a secret, we found life. And I just thought it was, you know, it's all in joke and in jest because people love to talk about these things. But also in all seriousness, at a certain level, you know, JPL has admitted to the possibility. And I say admitted because of the Voyager missions. So the Voyager missions have the golden record on them. And the golden record is meant for if there is intelligent life out there and they come across our little satellite, and are able to interpret the message that we sent them, then, well, who knows what will happen next. But there was definitely a disagreement about even including that on the spacecraft, and I find it interesting because, you know, some people are like, oh, well, should we really be putting ourselves out there like that? And I was like, well, if there's nothing there, then you should have nothing to worry about. So it's definitely not... It's not something that everyone agrees on or anyone disagrees on, but the possibility is certainly there, certainly there. And as for myself, I can't really imagine a universe this fast where we are the only intellectual beings that exist, just personally.
I can't either, but so far I'm being forced to imagine that. So people at JPL don't resoundly dismiss all of this. They it's probably considered, even though it may not be the topic of the day, right?
Right, and you know, most of the talk I hear definitely centers more on, is there life, period, outside of our own? We need a starting place, of course. I haven't actually had any serious conversations or heard anyone seriously talking about aliens, for example. That, not so common. Though sometimes we do have people who will stand in front of JPL who are saying that we're keeping the aliens secret. So that's always an interesting twist of the day that gets people talking.
John is in Tucson, and I guess he's joking around with us, but he said, have you ever visited the part of JPL that does the back engineering on the flying saucers?
I mean, if I had, would I be able to tell you?
Well, would we be able to believe you? So I don't know that it would matter what you told us. So I guess he's trying to stay in the spirit of your Halloween party, although that's a couple of months behind us now. Do you get to pick your missions? Do you get assigned in terms of your instrument operation? How does that work at JPL? Do you volunteer? What do you do?
It's kind of something that you work out with your group supervisor, and your group supervisor is basically in charge of your career versus somebody who's above you on a project who wants to make sure that what you're working on is a success. So with my group supervisor, I think he's amazing. And he loves to ask me and check in and ask, you know, after you get done working on Maya, for instance, what do you see yourself doing? Do you want to stay doing Earth-type missions, or would you be open to trying out Mars operations? So he is really great because he keeps an open dialogue with me and my coworkers about what we would like to do. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be able to do it when the time comes because it is about money, so you might have only two positions open and three people interested, so it's not like you are guaranteed to get the products you want to work on. And sometimes it's the timing that doesn't work out so well. But I definitely feel like I have a say in the types of projects I want to take on next, and that he does his best to try and meet my goals.
Allison is in Kansas City, and she said, I'd like to go back to possibly settlement on Titan. Do you think our life support as we know it today in space would be adequate for humans to make it to Titan and to stay there on the surface, say for a couple of years and then maybe return? Or would we need to make giant leaps in how we do life support to handle a place like Titan?
I would say giant leaps. Now, this is, again, where I have my disclosure that I'm no expert in this area, but when I was in college, I studied abroad for a summer, or did research, actually, in Italy. And the topic of the research was on a lunar greenhouse, specifically. And over that summer, what I learned was that growing stuff in space is hard, and then you have the problem of growing the right kind of stuff in space. And so even just making sure that people have the ability to make food in a way that's not time-consuming, as in you don't have to play farmer all the time, in a way that the food that you've chosen can actually grow and that you don't need to bring a lot of things with you, like dirt or water, all of that is difficult, and we haven't quite figured that out yet. So if we can't even try, if we haven't done a demonstration of that yet on the moon or at Mars, there have been some experiments on the International Space Station, however, but we haven't quite gotten to this greenhouse, this semi-autonomous greenhouse that can help us grow food. And food is just one of the many things that we will need if humans are going to survive. Another thing, of course, is air, the air that we breathe. Now, the Mars 2020 rover that's going to be launching this July is carrying on board an instrument called MOXIE. And MOXIE is going to be doing something that will prove as useful technology for any future settlement in our solar system, and that's converting the atmosphere at Mars into oxygen that we can use for many, many other things. And so that's another thing that we need to test and see if we can get that to work someplace where we can get the results pretty quickly. I could go on and on.
Well, here's another question that may allow you to go on. Randy's in Denver, and he said, I don't know very much about Titan, but if it has such a thick atmosphere, is radiation on the surface a problem?
That is a great question, and to give you the honest answer, I don't know. If I were to take a guess, I would say that the atmosphere probably helps with protecting us a little bit from that radiation that we'd be exposed to in space. So I would probably give that a thumbs up versus Mars or the moon. Mars has very little atmosphere, very, very little atmosphere, and the moon has none. So I would consider that in the pros category for Titan, actually. Great thing to bring up, though, because radiation is just one of those other things where you're going to have people out there in space for long periods of time. You need to make sure you have a plan in place for protecting them, because space is a harsh, harsh environment. And radiation is no joke.
Are the instruments that you work on, what do they typically do to protect for radiation? I know they harden. Is that sufficient, or do they encase them in things that are hardened? How do they protect against space radiation and get them to last for so many years?
Well, it kind of depends on how much money the project has. And I say that in all honesty. So hardened parts cost a considerable amount of money compared to their not hardened counterparts. And so anything that is susceptible to single bit upsets or other problems that can be caused by radiation, we try to protect them if we have the money to do so. But if you don't, you will expect to see problems. You will see problems, guaranteed.
Well, wouldn't it be more expensive to not protect them and then have problems on the mission or instrument failure?
Yes, you were so right. But it turns out that we are not the ones to get to choose our budget. we can propose our budget, but ultimately it's a congressional decision where how much money we're able to get. And even then, if something changes in politics, a mission that was fully funded before can be defunded very quickly. And so I always advocate for, if you're going to build it, at least build it right. But it's not always the case.
But Congress is not micromanaging the budget and saying, you can't spend this much for radiation proofing. Someone at JPL is making the decision on how to allocate the budget that you're given, correct?
Yes. I don't want to say that I can't really speak too much on how the financials actually work, because that's not the level that I work at least here. But if you don't have the money, you don't have the money at the end of the day. Even if you could move things around, you may be sacrificing, you know, what the mission was all about in the first place. But to tell you, what I said was, you know, something that happened, but not something that happens all the time. Like, I can tell you now that with Maya, we are not expecting to experience issues related to radiation. We will expect every now and then having a hiccup, especially over the South Atlantic anomaly, but we also have in place ways to combat that. So, you know, checking our data as it gets sent and making sure that it looks correct, or if there was a bit flip, flagging that data so that we know about it on the ground. So we are able to also plan around the possibility of radiation affecting our instruments, too.
What do you actually do to harden something? Can you tell us what that process is?
I don't know much at all about that process, but it sounds really interesting.
Is it, you know, so are they making the instruments differently, or is it they put them inside of something, or both?
It definitely has to do with material. I'm just thinking of, you know, I'm thinking of the environmental tests that we do here, basically.
Uh-huh.
You're just trying to make sure that whatever you're testing is meeting the requirements that you set for it. So, I mean, with temperature, it's that if we raise the temperature or thermal cycle this part, a bunch of times, it still should act the way that we wanted it to act. And I assume the same thing goes on with rad hard parts. They are just rated that if they're exposed to the radiation, they should still be performing the way they should be. And that's kind of how the specifications work, but I don't know much at all about the manufacturing of the parts and how those are different.
Have you given any thought to how life in a Titan settlement might be different from Europa or Enceladus or even Mars, as to what might be more fun or more preferable based upon the kind of life you might have on the object?
Sure. So I think that it's really important to point out that the fact that Titan has these methane lakes, that's really unique. There's no other place in our solar system where we found something like that before. So that means that we don't have to live a life devoid of being able to, you know, go for a swim in your local lake.
So you could swim in a methane lake?
You could. You would need protective gear on, but you could, yes. And I think that that's pretty cool. There are a lot of... Titan has a lot of Earth-like qualities that would make you feel more at home than perhaps Enceladus. I mean, Enceladus is absolutely beautiful, but I'm not sure how it would feel to live on ice. or Europa, for instance. There is a proposed, but not funded yet, but hopefully will be funded in the future, project to have a Europa submarine, which sounds amazing. Now, if they could get that technology working and they could bring people in a submarine under the surface of an Enceladus or a Europa, I might start getting interested.
That'd be a great tourist feature, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, JPL sometimes comes up with these fun little goodies that they give all the employees. And one year they made a patch and some stickers for us. And one of the stickers was on Enceladus, I believe. And it showed, like, a hockey team. So just shows some of the activities you could do going to these various places.
Joy is in Boston, and she says, I'm curious, David mentioned that you do STEM and STEAM outreach work. Do you talk to the kids that you're working with about what you're talking about on the space show, like going to Titan and maybe having settlement there? Are they interested in these topics? Does going someplace far away, looking for life or trying to live there, interest them?
You know, I really like this because it's put an idea in my mind. Normally when I talk to kids, a lot of the children or the students, I should say, that I talk to, sometimes for, well, I should say for the majority of them, it's the first time that they've met someone who even works in this field. So I try not to blow their minds too quickly. I want to keep them on board. And what I like to do is I like to talk about my journey from New Jersey to basically here and how I didn't have everything figured out. And it wasn't something that I planned my whole life and I was perfect all the time and that's how I ended up here. The most important thing I can possibly do for them is to put it in their mind that it's possible for them to have a job just like mine. And then the next thing I try to put in their mind is inspiration or that spark that makes them want to seek more information on their own. And my go-to for these outreach events that I do, it's almost always surrounding the amazing time I had on the Cassini mission, because I have videos and I have photos of just this event that happened and how it made me feel, and I'm able to convey the emotions that built, and not just the science stuff, because if I give them too much of the technological
facts, something like that.
Facts, exactly. They might start to zone out and start to think, you know, this might not be for me. I don't really like math, or I'm not that great at physics, so this can't be a job for me. But instead, I try to instill the emotional excitement that I feel when I talk about these things. But that being said, I don't know what's wrong with me. I should have been talking about Titan and Enceladus in this way. I always highlight Enceladus in my Cassini talks, but Titan is a great example of settlement, and that's an amazing starting point for that spark to grow of, wow, one day maybe I can live somewhere else. So thank you for the suggestions, because I will definitely be using it.
Here's another one. Do you give your STEM students, I'll call them students, I'm not sure if that's what they are or aren't, a special JPL tour?
If they request one, I'm happy to do it.
Do they know that they can request one?
So I am slowly but surely working on how I can reach more students, a greater amount of students, in a shorter amount of time. Normally, all of my outreach kind of stems around, you know, someone at JPL sending out a request that such and such school is having a STEM day and really wants a JPLer to come and talk about what they do here. And I'll volunteer to go to that event. Or I'll go to a conference and be at a NASA or JPL booth and talking about, you know, what JPL does as a whole, and connect with maybe a teacher. And she says, oh, well, maybe you can call in, or we can Skype, or maybe you can come to the school if they're local. Everything is kind of like ad hoc. Nothing is, I don't have a very standardized form, but I've been working on my own personal website, and I have an alpha version out there, but I have not publicized it in any way, shape, or form. That's the next step. But what I hope I can do in that is allow people to be able to contact me and request a tour. The only thing is that I can't be overwhelmed with it, because tours are on my own time, and I do need to do work at a certain point. So since tours can only be done during the JPL work day, it's a little bit difficult to be able to just offer them to everyone, but I'm always more than happy and excited to do it if I am free, have the time, because being here is just so many levels up from just hearing about this place.
Yeah, I would think it in. I was fortunate to have a JPL friend several years ago give me a tour, and it was really, really special. So I still remember it today.
Wow. See, that's what I mean. It's just being here is something you don't forget. And also, if you ever want a tour, you have my information.
Well, I'm ready for another one. To tell you how long ago it was, I saw them through the plate glass windows. I was mm-hmm. not allowed in the room, working on the Curiosity rover.
So wow.
How many years? I mean, you were probably 4 years old when we were doing that.
That so, is awesome. That's such a nice juxtaposition, because Mars 2020 is in that clean room right now, and I'm sure it looks very similar to how it looked to you when you came.
Probably, and hopefully Mars 2020 will be as successful as I believe Curiosity has been. At least most of us think it's been really, really cool and successful. I have another one for you. Bob is in Sacramento, and he says, I'm curious to know your thoughts about the private sector getting so heavily involved in space with rockets and possible human spaceflight and possible missions. Do you see the private sector as maybe competing with what you do at JPL someday, or is it a partner or a plus, or you don't pay any attention to it?
I definitely think that what the private sector is doing in space is a plus. They are driving the technology. They are making it cheaper to accomplish what we want to accomplish, and I really can't see any drawbacks. As far as seeing them as a competitor, I can see why people may think that, but from the standpoint of somebody at JPL whose main goal is to do these robotic missions so that we can explore our solar system and learn about where we came from, I don't see much crossover when it comes to the goals of what the private sector is trying to do. I mean, let's face it, there's no money in what JPL is doing right now. We don't go to Mars with a rover and sampling things to make money. We do it so that we can learn. We're doing it for knowledge and for not just taking that knowledge, but sharing it with the public, which is another huge part of what we do. And so while the private sector is very focused on trying to find ways to make it possible for the average person like me and you to be able to pay for a trip to space, I'm all for that. I would love for that to be an opportunity for me. But when it comes to doing things because you want to know, out of curiosity, out of an understanding of how to better protect our own planet, that's something that is, I don't think that many people are going to try and take over from NASA and JPL, so I'm not worried at all.
Listeners, we still have program time if you would like to use the phone tonight instead of email, 1-866-687-7223. We would like to get your calls. We always want your calls. But you can still use email, and we still have time for a few more. Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. I have a question for you about returning to the moon. And Penny's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And she says, many of us are really very keen and excited about going to the moon. You guys have been talking for 1 hour, and you've talked about all sorts of other places in the solar system, but you've not talked about the moon, which is the closest possible place and probably maybe one of the best places to start human settlement because it is so close by. Can you comment on the moon and space settlement or going back to the moon? What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. And you know what? Moon, I am sorry. Because I neglected to mention that I also work on a lunar project. I have an instrument called Diviner that's on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been there for about 10 years in operations at the moon, and my instrument has played a huge part of discovering what looks to be ice at the caps of the moon. So I have a lot of faith in going to the moon to Mars, using the moon as a base before even getting to Mars, because of the resources we may be able to harvest in situ there. Like I said, I kind of always been a fan of building a base at the moon, and it sent back to that time I spoke about in college when I was doing the lunar greenhouse research. And, you know, it would be amazing. I mean, we've done it before, right? And we've done it before on less technology than we have in our cell phone. So it's not exactly a matter of can we do it? It's will we? And thankfully, the answer, according to the government at least, is that we will. So I am all for this future push to bring us back to the moon. We have advanced so much as humanity, as a civilization, that there's so much more that we can do this time around.
Your instrument from LRO is still working?
It is still working. In fact, I built all the commands through Sunday today for it.
Interesting. So how does it have such a long life?
Oh, well, I think that's kind of like a JPL secret spice. A lot of our missions are only supposed to last through their prime, and then that's what they were. We were given the money to give them a prime mission.
Right.
We often are given extended missions and last longer. That's because, you know, a lot of times we plan for things. So we might have redundant systems on board that we know have a good chance of, not a good chance, but they have a chance of failing, for example. So we're not just taken out by one failure. We have a backup plan. And we have teams who are just so smart that they can find ways to use what little we have to keep us going. And I know I keep using Cassini as an example, but it's because it's what I know. And, you know, Cassini was not supposed to last as long as it did at Saturn. It was going to run out of fuel. And the people in charge of navigation came up with the idea of using Titan, our moon of topic tonight, as a gravitational assistant, in essentially, to keep us slingshotting in our orbit around Saturn. And so, you know, people are constantly thinking of ways and innovating on, well, if something goes wrong, what can we do to fix it, instead of just kind of giving up.
Linda has been one of our best ever guests, and she was always willing to come on to talk about Cassini, and then she did great farewell programs with us on the demise of Cassini, which broke everybody's heart. We wish it had kept on going. But God, thanks to her, we got probably the equivalent of a PhD education in planetary missions.
I bet.
Especially Saturn. I hope she gets on to another project, and then we can start having her back on the show. She may already be on another project, so I just haven't kept up with it. I don't know. Do you know, is she back doing another project that we should contact her about?
That's a good question. I mean, she's definitely still walking around JPL. I've seen her. I'm not sure what she's working on these days, though. You know, Linda's, I look at her as a role model. I mean.
Oh, yeah, of course. She's gifted. And
yes.
I've also talked to her husband, who has written great sci-fi books, and a great team. I have another question for you from a student. So, Jerry is a student, and I don't know if it's a female Jerry or a Jerry or a male Jerry, okay? But he or she is in Miami, and I'm assuming we're talking Florida, but I don't know that for sure either. And Jerry says, David mentioned in your introduction that you're from MIT. I'm interested in studying aerospace engineering, but I don't have the grades nor the money to go to MIT or some of the top aerospace engineering schools in the country, and I know there are many, like USC, Colorado, Texas, etc. But I have been accepted to an aerospace engineering school that is not a household name. Can you tell me, and be honest, are my chances for working at NASA or JPL diminished because I'm not coming out of a school of the quality of MIT?
Jerry, that is a great question, and I will in turn give you an honest response. Your chances are never zero when it comes to working at a place like NASA or JPL. I have met people here, and I've had coworkers whose first career was in something so totally different think like liberal college and going into something like editing turned somebody who works on projects like Cassini doing science and engineering. So I would be doing you a wrong by telling you there is no chance whatsoever. But what I want to say is that use this school that you're going to now as a stepping stone. You have the ability to put all your time and effort into doing very, very well in the program you are in now. And you can use that as a way to get into a graduate school that will not only, I mean, with STEM, a lot of graduate programs will pay for you to come there. So what I would say is every year that you're in this school, you should be applying to a JPL internship. Because, one, you just never know what may happen. And it gives you experience in doing that. And then, two, you should be setting your sights on doing as well as you can at the school you are at now and looking to continue your education at some of these other institutions that maybe for now you weren't able to get into or maybe you didn't have the money for. That could definitely be options for you once you graduate. I wish you the best of luck, too. You can do it.
Sounds like your STEM talk that you're giving at the YWCA. I have found that to be true, and I've also found that once you get to a place like JPL or pretty much any place, nobody is saying, what school did you go to? And then
right. If
they're not familiar with it, they ignore you.
Oh, my goodness.
I've never seen any of that ever happen, so I think it's really what you create, Jerry, and your ability and how you market yourself. And
you
can do that probably by getting an accredited correspondence degree course, for all I know, if you're good at it. So don't let the image of the school thwart you. They could even have a top football team and you still couldn't get into JPL. So keep that in mind. Is JPL going to be your only career, or you think down the road you may do something else in space? Would you like to go on a space mission? Would you like to be like a space tourist or something like that?
Well, from where I'm looking at, my vantage point is looking more and more like I may be one of those JPL lifers just because I am enjoying the work that I do so much. And when I talk to my friends from college or even from high school and hear them talk about their jobs, I can sense a sort of happiness for, being paid well, but not necessarily fulfillment. And I realize that I'm very lucky to have found this fulfillment so early on in my career, and I don't think it'd be a good idea for me to let it go. But thinking of other things in the realm of space, I say this kind of jokingly, and because I have friends here at JPL who could seriously be amazing candidates, I do sometimes think about what it would be like to be an astronaut. And I am not one of those people who have dreamed of it their entire life, who have planned for it, and who everything they do is to make themselves a better applicant. But I do think that if I one day got serious about it, it'd be something I would really like to experience.
So you've not applied for an astronaut yet, have you?
I have not, but one of my friends is trying to convince me to apply this year if they open up the applications again.
Well, then you could be a private sector astronaut with SpaceX, for example, and go to Mars.
That is true. I would like to see someone else go first. Then I'll go.
What have we missed anything about Titan or your instrument engineering position or JPL or that we should be talking about that you think would be interesting, to people on the outside, even space advocates who know a lot about space,
mm-hmm.
JPL is this kind of mysterious place where fantasy comes true. I mean, it's not like fantasy in Disneyland, which is always going to be fantasy, but you guys put together these missions that 5 or 10 years ago nobody could even dream of, and even see that they work, which is pretty amazing. Like Pluto, for example. I know that's
right.
That's a you know, an applied physics lab mission, but you do all of this stuff that nobody can really kind of grasp. It's like it's mysterious, and so we look in through what you and others talk about in your missions, but we really don't know a whole lot about it and how it happens that you can do things that work on another world when you just think about it. And you know, they have to fly through space for years and years and years to even get to their destination. The whole thing sounds, you know, like it's a storybook topic. I mean, how do you unload a Mars rover and have it work for all these years and do all of these things? Or how do you plan to put a submarine on Europa, for example? Or how do you do New Horizons? So it is... looking in from the outside, it really is a magical kingdom where you work, and more so, I think, than other NASA centers.
I feel the same. I feel the same. There are mighty things is kind of our mantra, and, you know, you learn that unless you dare mighty things, you can't really reach these pinnacles of humanity and do these incredible, incredible things, and so I stick by that. To have some last words on Titan, I did take the time to look up the mission that I mentioned before that is slated to go back to Titan. It's called Dragonfly, and
right. It's
supposed to be a helicopter that can actually land there. So just wanted to make sure people knew about that if they wanted to do their own research, but we do have one in the works right now as we speak.
Yeah, we've actually talked about it. It's kind of a hopping drone or something that they're doing. And again, it goes back to that thick atmosphere that it can fly there. So, which is pretty cool.
And, absolutely.
And the fact that they can even control it on
so far
on
away.
It's pretty amazing. Any chance you would be on that project, or it's already filled out and set in stone?
We are far, far from that. Well, maybe not too far, but it's set to launch in 2026. We will see. I haven't really heard much about it, and I'm not even sure if JPL is the one taking the lead on that project, but I definitely will be paying attention. Its transit seems to be pretty long, so a couple of years, and I'm not so excited about the journey as much as I am about the destination, in this case as an instrument operator, but I am very excited to see what we're able to do.
So there is a chance, if this mission really happens, that you could be involved with it?
There is a chance. I'll say it.
I hope that happens, and then you can be our go-to person on Dragonfly.
Oh, that would be amazing.
I want to thank you very much for doing an almost full-length 90-minute program tonight. I think the fact that you're reaching out to other people and working to get them interested in this is really fabulous, and hope you keep doing that. I think you can seal the deal if you take them to JPL. Just keep that in mind.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, David. I've enjoyed all of the questions. It makes me really happy to see that there are people who are interested in seeing what JPL is up to, and I just really appreciate the support, the interest, the spreading the word, and shows like yours are important to what we do because, you know, our mission is impossible unless we have the support of the public. So thank you.
We will stay in touch, and if you have news on Titan and settlement, let us know. We would absolutely appreciate hearing from you, and we will talk some more about it.
Will do. All right, David, thank you very much.
Thank you. And listeners, our next live program is Friday morning, And again, Parabolic Arc, Doug Messier is our guest. We thank Janelle for being with us, and it's good night from David, Janelle, and the Space Show. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep looking up, and thank you for listening tonight.